The World Cup, on off the ball, covering the good, the bad, and, well, the ugly of what's happening in Qatar.
Neymar can push the ball between your legs because he just sees things.
Subscribe to the OTB Football Podcast feed now.
OTB GAA.
Welcome to the Mike Quirk Podcast.
Now give me my theme music.
This series is brought to you with the help of PST Sport. PST Sport is a design and build specialist contractor focusing exclusively on the design and construction of artificial grass pitches and supporting infrastructure for soccer, GAA, rugby, hockey and tennis. PST's portfolio includes over 50 FIFA certified artificial grass pitches, as well as multiple pitches tested and approved for World Rugby, GAA and FIH standards. PST Sports have done over 500 artificial grass pitches for clubs, schools, colleges and local authorities in Ireland and the UK for all different sporting codes. Visit pstsport.com for more details. Okay, folks, so welcome back again. Yeah, delighted to say this is our fourth episode. I didn't even think we'd have a first series, never mind a fourth episode of the second series. So this one is probably a little bit more basketball orientated in one sense. I've got Alan Keane. Alan Keane, people in Tralee and Kerry, Alan will know you. You'll be familiar to people from Tralee Tigers days back in the day. And now, obviously, you're based in the UK and you've done a lot of work in terms of coaching with UK basketball and different things. So delighted to get you on, man. Appreciate your time.
Mihal, it was an absolute pleasure, buddy. I was surprised when you reached out. I've listened to plenty of your podcast. Actually, during lockdown there, you kept me company with Russ Bradford on one of them, and there was many more. You're doing a great job.
I appreciate it. Why are you saying you were surprised, man? You didn't think I'd give you a
You know, I guess, you've dropped the bar for me today anyway. So it's a very low one to get over. We'll crack on anyway.
That's harsh criticism. Maybe, Alan, for the people that aren't as familiar with you, and obviously I've been reading up in the last couple of days, again, and looking at the different things that you're doing and that you have done, will you just kind of give people maybe a quick overview of some of the things that you've done in that kind of coaching sphere?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been living in the UK a long time now, Mike, probably too long really, but I've been over here probably 15 years, I'd say 16 years. I was in London for a good most of that, down in London for 14. I'm up in Scotland now for the last year and a half.
Okay.
But just coaching basketball, started out generally, worked my way up to the national team. I probably coached at about, I'm in double digits anyway of European championships, four or five of them are in Division A, so you're playing against Spain, Turkey, Greece, the bigger teams and stuff like that. Under 16s, under 18s, under 20s. Professional level here, Division 2, we'll call it. Is there for about 6 or 7 years down in Reading with Reading Rockets. And the past 2 years, I'm up here in Scotland with, it was Glasgow Rocks last year. This year's Caledonia Gladiators. And currently I'm sitting in a venue in Edinburgh. I'm a head of basketball for a club in Edinburgh, which is, mind-blowing. It's a podcast in itself, how this club operates, but really fascinating. So, and then on the side, John, I wear a different hat, I guess, as well, in terms of doing a lot of coach development, coach support. I run a company called Movement Sports with my colleague, Simon Turner, and we're working with coaches from Canada, the States, Austria, Germany, Australia. And that's been a fascinating one. Like, that's really, I'm finding that more. I don't know if I'm, somebody asked me one time, Mike, are you a coach or are you a coach developer? And it was an interesting question. I never thought about it intentionally like that before. But I'm somewhat, as much as I love coaching, it's in my heart, actually. And we had some great ones back in the day, didn't we, with Russ and Shawnee Burrs and those like. But actually, coach development is really stimulating me at the moment. And it's there's an interesting story maybe there to be told as we talk more.
Yeah, and that is a good question, man. Like, I often find as well, I think there's obviously great similarities between the two, coaching players, coaching children, adults, whatever it is, but then also in one sense, kind of coaching coaches and helping them develop or helping them learn and improve what they do.
Yeah. And the thing, I think it's a bit like playing, Mike, you see a lot of fellas there going into Premiership or even fellas in the NBA, the player who becomes the coach, they're not always very successful, but there's another side to it too. Like, you do have a different sense when you're coaching. Have you been a player? Like when a player walks in the gym and you're just reading the body language going, he's not himself today. And you can just tell the minute they walk in the door. I think being a player has enabled you to do that better maybe, or, you know, especially if you're early on in the career. But yeah, we'll get into it in a minute. We'll get into it, I'm sure. But it's a domain, Mike, that I'm torn at the moment. I love coaching. It's what I do 24/7, sadly, in some ways. But I'm getting disheartened. The more I support coaches and they let me into their world, I'm actually getting more disheartened about the domain and the state it's in at the moment, if I'm being honest.
Right. Okay. And before we get into that, and I'm sure we will, you're doing a PhD?
Yeah. Well, the last time we saw each other, I probably had a bit more hair. I've currently got more hair on my eyebrows than I do on the top of my head. And my PhD is a big part of that reason, Mike. I'm doing it. I'm probably 5 years in. Yeah, I think this will be I'm coming to the end of my fifth year. I'm hoping to submit my thesis in the next month or so. I say that every month, and I keep kicking the can down the road, like. But I'm doing it on self-regulated learning. So I'll tell you in a quick nutshell, Mike, what I had to do. I basically recorded myself for a year. It sounds very egotistical, but actually the main body of it is. Was recording all my timeouts, all the pregame, halftime, postgame, every training session. And I'd been doing that for years anyway, Mike, with the national team. I got into good practice about 5 or 6 years ago where I decided, you know what, I'm not sure the timeouts are effective. So I was getting the team manager or the physio or the S&C just to record every timeout. And I'd Monday morning, I'd go into the office and I'd watch my timeouts and I'd watch the halftime. And, you know, very often I didn't like what I saw, but it allowed me to pivot and make some changes. But I had to do that for the course of a year because it was all around, the project's all around, how can you coach somebody to be independent, interdependent with the teammates and self-motivated at acquiring new skills and knowledge, let's say. So back in our day, probably John Tehan ticked a lot of those boxes without us even knowing what self-regulated learning was, driven from within, didn't need somebody to drive him, motivated, would soak up everything a coach would say like a sponge. He had that in him. Now, where he got it from would fascinate me. Is that childhood? Is that parenting? Is that upbringing? Is that environment? But my project's taken me down the road of, well, how can I coach? What interventions can I use that enables a player to become more self-sufficient, self-managing? And I'm not talking about self-managing with their life, even though it carries over. I'm talking about being self-sufficient on the spot, under pressure. Game is in the flow. You're in action. You're going. Referee doesn't make a call, right? Where's your mind go next? And are you able to self-manage emotionally, but also are you able to self-manage in terms of decision making? So it goes a long way towards improving the decision maker for a player. So I've opened up a can of worms with it, really, Mike. Yeah. And the more I'm learning about it, the more I'm learning, geez, there's a rabbit hole here.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're getting there about a month ago.
That's always the way with study, man. And as soon as you start looking at something, you start realizing how little you actually know about a kind of an area or whatever. Yeah. But that's it. So you started, and I'll just stay with this for a minute, but you recorded timeouts, pre-game, post-game, your own, just yourself, what you were saying and what you were delivering, and your PhD was based around reviewing some of that information and analyzing that.
Absolutely, and there was interventions to put in place, like so. What I was recording was exactly what you say it is, what you said it was there, Mike. But I was intentional about the way I was coaching. I was intentional about the interventions I was using to enable players to do what I wanted them to do. So, for example, a lot of it was around stepping back from the players and kind of giving them a voice and a choice and not just rolling the balls out, stepping away. We're going down the athlete-centered approach to coaching here now with this conversation. But, like, it was very much around, right, fellas, you know, we do recall checks at the start of every training session. And the recall check is something I should have been doing as a teacher for 10 years and I never did it, really, looking back on it. But, you know, you come into the next practice and you step back, you put them into a scenario. You set the scenario. Rugby coaches are brilliant for this. Basketball coaches are terrible, in general speaking. You set up a scenario and you let them go and you step back. And now you're observing, trying to gather data. Are they recalling the stuff that you think that we're good at? And you soon find out we're not. So now you're pivoting your session going forward because actually they're not performing. They're not in the performance stage. They're still in the learning phase. So we need to spend more time with it. And it was enabling them to take timeouts in the practice and put a clock on them and stuff like that. So it was a lot of interventions around not just being independent, but being interdependent. So there's a lot of gravity on interdependency within the sessions.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm just like, it would be fascinating if you were a coach at any level to have somebody just recording, video recording or audio recording the stuff that you're actually saying and listening back with a critical ear. Even if you're talking, and again, I'm always conscious here, Alan, that like there's people who will be listening to this that are dealing with under sevens in soccer or rugby or basketball or whatever, and the same thing with 18s or seniors or whatever. So there's a big wide spectrum, but that's one that anybody, like, that you can have somebody observe you or record you, and just to pick up once or twice, a couple of times, and listen to the stuff you're actually saying.
Yeah,
I wonder how accurate or how effective or how impactful that kind of stuff is.
Massive, absolutely massive. And I won't repeat what you said there, because I'm just in completely agreement, but I'll take it to another level, let's say, or pivot slightly. Put a GoPro, put a chest harness and a GoPro on one of your players for 20 minutes in a practice session. So, like, for example, what's the common complaints we have? Oh, we don't talk, or guys, I've told them 100 times before, or, you know, we've covered this before, they're not doing it, they're not talking on defense, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we'll put a GoPro camera on their chest for 20 minutes, rotate the chest harness every 20 minutes, 2-hour practice, you've 6 players on video. Don't even watch it as a coach. All right, boys, here you go. There's your 20 minutes. There's your 20 minutes. Come back and tell me what you think. You know what they come back and say? Hey, coach, I'm sorry. You're right. I don't talk at all on defense. Or you know what? On that down screen there, I didn't call switch. You're right, coach. The camera doesn't lie.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent these days, John. There's a lot of talk. Or I keep going, John, Mike, there's a lot of talk around put the camera on yourself as a coach. But actually take the same principle and put it on the player. Like, mm-hmm. you can have some really rich conversations now, because when you sit down with a professional player, especially Mike, you're dealing with big egos there, like, and mm-hmm. fellas who are in self-preservation mode, and rightly so too, because they're being attacked left, right, and center, mm-hmm. and they're having to perform every time they step on the court. Like, you know, we don't perform as well as we're not spiked in our performances in our job every day, but we're expecting them to be, and they get critiqued when they don't. But actually, when you sit down and watch that video with a player, and you sit back and you ask questions from a place of curiosity, genuine curiosity. Like, I ask coaches all the time, how many times have you asked your player a question where you don't know the answer? Like, it doesn't happen. You know, we ask a question. Oh, yeah, I'm an athlete-centered coach. You ask questions. You're talking. You're telling them the answer before you even finish asking the question. But my point being, like, this is a great process to do with a player, not just a coach, you know?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. And I take us back there. So you obviously would have, you're from Tralee in Kerry. You would have played your basketball with Tralee Tigers. You got a good education from some of the coaches that you were dealing with there. You would have played obviously Irish international and that kind of stuff. How like, it's a big jump from there to, obviously you said, what, 15 years now you're over in the UK coaching and.
Yeah, and probably more than that, thereabouts anyway. Yeah.
And how did that stuff, like, you know, from coming from Tralee, from that level, how did that compare in terms of, I'm just thinking of coaching now, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody here, the level of coaching that you were getting there to where coaching has gone now, I suppose, is the question. Like, there's obviously been a huge transformation, or has there, in the type of coaching or how you were coached, or, you know, in the two different.
Yeah, great question. And you've got my juices flowing here, because I want to speak about somebody in particular. Whenever I refer to back home or I talk about my days back home, I had one coach, Mike, that taught me more about coaching that has made me a better coach, but has nothing to do with tech, and that was Shawnee Burrows. Mm-hmm. Shawnee Burrows as a coach, where, you know, not consciously at the time, but as I look back, Shawnee taught me how to care for people, how to care and be considerate of others. Shawnee taught me to care for others, and it wasn't intentional. He did it by the way he coached. I always felt I belonged. Anytime I walked into a Tigers practice when Shawnee was coaching, or Gat Carey, I felt like I belonged in those environments. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had coaches, not back home, more so over here, that, you know, you walk, and I've worked with coaches, you walk into the environment and the players are in fear. I'm talking about pro players here, you know, the players are coming to you as an assistant going, oh, how's the head coach today? They're on eggshells wanting to know, is he in a good mood or a bad mood? I never felt that way with the coaches I had, you know, back home. And Shawnee sits top of that tree, really, top of that mountain. And Russ said something to me one time. Russ Bradford said, when I went into coaching early, you know, I reached out to Russ and I said, look, come on, man, you've been there a lot. You know, you've forgotten more than I'll ever know. Like, give me some advice here. long time ago. I don't know if he'll remember. He said to me, he said, look, Alan, he said, don't worry about the superstars. He said, everyone's looking after them. He said, you know, their egos have been stroked daily. He says, those players 9 through 12 that sit down the end of your bench, make sure you make those fellas feel special. Make sure they feel like that they're respected, that they matter. You know, just make sure that make go the extra mile. And when I reflect back there, Mike, I think Russ did that because I was one of those 9 through 12 there for a period of time. And, you know, I always felt like Russ was on my side. I wasn't just there to make up numbers and stuff, you know. So there were great, bits of advice I got, better than any tech tack. Yeah, you're right about the game, Mike. It has grown, and it's probably grown too much, too fast, too quick. And I think there's diminished returns on investment of time from coaches being put into the tech tack. The game is simple. Do less and do it better is a very simple philosophy. But I'll end this. I'll shut up here in a second by saying, Sean, we have a motto there with the company we run at Movement Sports. You know, we tell our coaches all the time, and they don't buy in. They don't all buy in. Some do. A better understanding of who you coach will enable you to better coach what you want to coach and how you want to coach it. And this isn't, we're coaching people, like, you know, this isn't rocket science. You know, I mean, I look back and greatest teammate, like Kieran Donahue and yourself are two great teammates. But you were people, you were a people's player, Mike. So was Kieran. Like, you know, they play for other people. They don't play, you guys didn't play for yourselves, you play for other people. And coaching's the same. You're dealing with people. It's not rocket science. The fellas who are spending all day long on Twitter, getting, you know, new plays, new drills. That's good stuff. And you do need a knowledge base. I'm not yeah. diminishing that at all. You need a knowledge base, but a better understanding of who you coach will enable you to do all that stuff so much better.
Yeah. And obviously you spoke about Russ there, and Russ, for people who wouldn't be sure, even though Russ was on, he would have been on the last series we had, Russ would have coached the Tralee Tigers back in the day. And he was also an assistant coach at UTEP from Texas El Paso and different things. Really, really interesting character as well, and good guy. And would always have been one of those fellas, Alan, that was, you know, hugely concerned with the entire group, as opposed to, as you say, the top three or four guys or whatever. Those guys are always getting looked after and well, you know, supported. But it's trying to make those other guys feel, you know, as big a part of it as everybody else is the key thing. And like going back to Shawnee Burrows, you mentioned it there, and this has come up. This is a recurring theme, and this is why I kind of enjoy doing this, because I like people to hear this stuff, because everybody thinks it's about how you set up and how you play and what type of defense you're playing, if it's basketball or it's football or it's soccer, the runs you're doing or any of that stuff. The recurring theme over all of these is about coaches developing a relationship with the people that they're coaching. And you mentioned it in Shawnee Burrows' case, that you felt he cared, like he cared for the players, he cared for you. And then you're more, you want to play well, you want to train, you want to get better, you want to improve, because this guy is looking out for you more than just what you were able to deliver to him.
No question. Shawnee to me, right? Shawnee had it all, Mike, because he taught me how to shoot, right? And I think back in my younger years, I would be known as a decent shooter anyway. And I can remember Shawnee pulling me to the side after an under 15 training session above in the sports complex, showing me the correct technique of how to shoot. It's the first time any coach ever did that. And I, you know, the way he taught me is what I remember. I remember the technique, but I was locked in and listening to him because he did it from a place of care. He did it with an authenticity that had me locked in. I mean, you know, it's like as a player, Mike, players can see through coaches. Like a coach is like a pane of glass. Like, and I think the sooner we realize that, the better. It doesn't, like, it's okay to have bad days as well and stuff, but you know, you hear a lot. Can I go off on a tangent here now, right?
Shoot away, man.
So cut me off at any point. You hear a lot about coaches these days saying, no, I'm a player's coach or I'm a relationship coach. And that's great stuff. And I love the intention. And I applaud coaches who actually have that mindset. The question will always remain, well, what are you doing? What are you tangibly doing that's enabling you to be a person-centered coach? Or you put the person before the player. What do you do intentionally? And I'll share one idea with you. There's a very simple way to do this. One thing is on your practice plan, where we're writing all the drills and times and the teams and the structure and the teaching points and stuff, before you write any of that stuff, at the top of your session plan, Write down three people that you'll connect with before tonight's practice. Micheál Quirk, Kieran Donaghy, Kevin O'Donoghue. That's some three-on-three team there, Mike, isn't it? Anyway, so you write down Mike, Kieran, Kevin on the top of your session plan. And next to that, you write down what I'm going to connect with them about tonight. Mike, I recognize Mike was looked a little disgruntled when he left practice last night. Check in with him tonight. Kieran's, you know, he's working hard. His body's taking a beating. Just get a real perspective on where he's at with his body. Does he need a day off? Kevin, I know Kevin's dog died a couple of days ago. He's probably feeling down. Check with him. How's life? Are they going to get a new dog? So you're being intentional about who you check in. When you write that down in a session plan, it does a couple of things. Because we all think, oh, I'm going to do it. Everybody wants to do it. But when you write it down in a session plan, when you're a coach and you walk into the gym, you're getting pulled in six or seven different directions. You forget to check in with the people you were going to check in with. So you get to the end of the session or during the session, oh, geez, I never checked in with Mike. It's written on the session plan. I generally do it after the training session because you do get pulled in different directions. The second thing it does for you is actually goes, right, I checked in with those three guys last practice. I'm going to check in with somebody. So you're actually spreading the load. Let's say you're widening who you're checking in with instead of the same five or six people all the time. Because it's generally on the pro level here, it's generally the guy that's getting the speeding fines, or he's not keeping the apartment tidy, or he's misbehaving and blah, 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 or his attitude's poor. They're the guys you're generally giving these one-to-ones for. And they're spit like a teacher with the naughty kids. Like, you know, you're generally being all your energy's being pulled there. But actually, if you write this stuff down, you become a bit more intentional about getting across the team.
Yeah, and actually, I spoke to Frank Dick in the last one, and Frank was making the very same point about I was asking about culture and developing a kind of a positive team culture, and one of those things was, you know, there's no point putting a big sign up on the wall about what it is you're going to do or putting a thing into your pocket. It has to be lived, and it has to be kind of real and living and breathing. And that's one of the kind of things that he was speaking about as well, is that idea of highlighting a couple of guys before your session and really going after them and catching them doing stuff well. And, you know, being I suppose that idea, like, we're very quick as coaches to catch people doing stuff wrong or to correct them when they're not doing stuff right. But that idea of being intentional about catching them doing stuff right and checking in the way that you talk about is obviously a very powerful thing.
You've hit the nail on the head. Of course, you have things you've talked about, a legend there, like in coaching. But Stephen Rolnick's a fascinating guy, Mike, you should look up, right? He's a clinical psychologist, and he was working in the medical industry for 40 years. But he's all his work was around, how can I connect with people quickly and have them and facilitate them to engage in change talk. So he worked with a lot of addicts and people that were reforming from difficult times and different things like that. And now think on the extreme level. Stephen talks a lot about, like, wearing strength lenses and not being a deficit detector. And as coaches, he's now working with coaches. He's done amazing stuff with us with movement in terms of educating us, let's say.
Right.
But he's a big advocate of coaches need to wear strength lenses more and stop being deficit detectors, because anytime we're watching a performance, we're generally deficit detecting. And it's so easy to go there. And I remember talking to one of our movement members at the start of the season. He's coaching a pro women's team. And he was telling me, oh, you know, she's hard work. She's this. And I just said, look, tell me the things that she does well. Let's park all that. Now tell me what she does well. And the stuff you told me there shrinks all the bad stuff, but your mind is only on the bad stuff. So now how can you increase the good stuff that will hopefully dampen down the bad stuff? So Stephen Rolnick, wear strength lenses versus being a deficit detector is one. And the other thing you talked about there that had my thoughts flying around, Mike, was I want to share something with you about, you talked about environment and culture and stuff and living the behaviors and things like that, you know, because culture is basically people like us do things like this here. You're able to describe your behavior, what you do. Mm-hmm. People like us do things like this. That's culture. It could be good or it could be bad. It's culture. You're living it, basically. There's a thing called the care climate that we're digging down into. And I think it's a fascinating, fascinating direction for all coaches to go. Now, it's fairly new in terms of its usage in the sports world. Colm Cronin out of Liverpool, John Morris, another Irish fella, Colin Crowe now, Liverpool John Moores University, is helping me massively bring it to life here in the club I'm currently in. And it's something I'm kind of squeezing into the end of my studies. But basically, a care climate is measuring the level of care that exists in your environment. So now we're talking about the sports world. So we've done some work with some college coaches in the States on this. And you know what? The data that came out of it has a lot of gravity. It's pretty hard hitting, if I'm being honest. So it'll probably help if I talk you through the process. It's effectively anonymous questionnaires that we as a third party would give to the athletes, to the players. And it's the questionnaire is on three different levels. On the first level, the players are answering questions around the relationship from player to player. What's it like? And it's all anonymous. Like, so there's a safe space to put in whatever you want. The second phase is around coach-athlete relationship. So players' perspectives on the coach-athlete relationship. And then the third phase is all around the environment. So the coach's coaching, the practice session, what it feels like. And it's a lot around belonging and, you know, do I feel like I belong here? Do I feel respected? Do I feel heard? Do I feel looked after? Do I feel safe? And some of the stuff that comes out of these questionnaires, like for a coach to say, to read that and go, actually, they think I'm demonstrative. Mm. Coach, you know, I was promised this, but the reality is that, you know, he doesn't give me any time, but spends all his time with these four players over here. So you're actually, it can be hard hitting, but you're measuring the level of care that exists in your environment. Now, the right way to do it is probably four times a year, four treatment points. You baseline your start, you baseline the end, and you do two assessments in the middle. And that information, Mike, can allow a coach to go away and go, we're 3 months in, this is awful. I've got to really consider how I'm speaking to the players. Now we're speaking to the players in a way because it's based on results and there's job security and all these other dimensions that fit in there. But, you know, if you are really bringing your culture to life or that billboard or that poster to life, all these things you say are a culture, well, then what are you doing to measure that? Where's your evidence that that culture is alive and well? Because if you're not measuring the impact of your coaching, how do you know you're coaching well? How do you know you're not coaching better? Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And how can you do it better? What three great questions I stole from Dan Abrahams, by the way, I didn't come up with those. What great three questions to ask yourself? What am I doing? Why am I doing it this way? And can I do it better? You know, now if we talk about culture with those three questions, you're probably moving in a healthy direction.
Yeah, and it's they're very simple and very straightforward. But if you can answer those well, and you have a really well thought out, solid answer for each of those, then you're probably not in a very poor place. You know, that's really interesting. That clear care climate, and like I just find all that stuff fascinating. And I know a lot of coaches that are like, you know yourself, man, that like the talk of soft skills or the idea of, you know, the people skills and being able to speak to people, it's just not weighted. Any of the coach education stuff that you go through, which I think a lot of it is not fit for purpose anyway, but any of that stuff that you go through by any of the NGBs, it's all weighted so heavily on the technical and the tactical side of things and how we set up a training session, how we do that. And again, like the point you made, that's all necessary, especially if coaches are starting out. They need to develop a bank of that kind of information so that what they're delivering is of a decent quality. But there should be so much weight put on that idea of developing your people skills. And regardless of your, you know, brilliance as a technical coach, if your people skills are strong, you're going to keep people playing games for an awful lot longer than they probably are right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I won't repeat what you said, but I'll summarize it by saying, like, we've all been to coaching courses, Mike, that's, you know, talked about the tech, as you said, or even a little bit about culture, nothing about managing people, nothing about how do you, like, you take over head coaching. I'm supporting a coach that's a pro coach in Northern Europe at the moment, right? And he came out of the college coaching in the States, and now he's coaching pro in a country here in Europe. First year. I mean, his challenges are not tech. His challenges are not scouting reports. They're not practice design, training design. His biggest challenge is having difficult conversations with ownership, difficult conversations with players, difficult conversations with end of the bench players, difficult conversations with superstars. There's no coaching course that's prepared him for that. How do you navigate a difficult conversation with another human being? Because you know as yourself, with all the years' experience you've had, I can imagine you've witnessed and potentially been involved into some degree some really tricky conversations with coaches or ownership or management to some degree. But we're doing it blindfold. We're doing it blindly. And I think at some point, like, somebody has to come out with a coach development course, dare I say it, a coach development course that enables a coach to navigate the daily reality challenges of working in that environment. It's ain't tech tech, man. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what YouTube's there for. You know?
Yeah.
That's the hard bit, buddy. That's the real hard bit.
Like Frank spoke about the difference between what you can be taught and what you need to learn. And obviously what you need to learn is that people side of it. And you only are going to learn that by being exposed to those kind of situations where you are in a conversation with a player about, you know, something that's not working out or something that he's doing well or whatever it is. And like through those experiences is what gives you that learned knowledge, I suppose, to be able to handle those stuff a little bit better.
Let me ask you this, right? You're asking great freaking questions. You got my mind really flowing here, and I'm tired by it.
And you didn't even get my name right for the first 25 minutes of it.
How could I forget my part? But do you know what the question that should be asked, though, Mike, is if we're saying this and it's commonly experienced, why aren't coaches tackling it and approaching it more? You know, I have my thoughts as to why, which I'll share with you. But, you know, when teams aren't winning and teams aren't doing well in basketball world anyway, you know, I don't know the Gaelic football world as well, like so, or the soccer world or rugby world as well. But in the basketball world, when teams aren't doing well, the coach generally adds in a new set play, new tactic, new formation, new schemes, new defensive philosophies, new concepts. The solution very often isn't there. The solution is actually in dealing with people. And I'll tell my opinion on why I think it's coaches go towards the tech, because it's freaking hard to sit down and have a difficult conversation with another human being because it's emotionally laborious. Mm-hmm. It drains the life out of you. And it's hard. It's easier to say, do you know what? Let's put in a new horns offense there because he's not getting enough touches. Or, you know what? Oh, geez, we're allowing him. We're giving up 90 points a game. Let's put in next coverage on ball screen defense. No lens towards actually, am I doing something that they're able to do or doing something I want to do for an alternative reason? Where actually, if I peel this all the way back, go, hang on a second, I just need to sit down and have some difficult conversations with these guys and say, your behavior is unacceptable, that's not going to be tolerated here anymore. And if it is, here's what's going to happen. Hard work to do that, especially the higher up the level you go. It's hard work, man.
Absolutely. And I wrote down there, it's easier to do the technical and tactical stuff. Like that's easy. It's those conversations that are a little bit difficult. And again, I'm talking here, you know, not so much even difficult conversations, but talking to, 313s about how do we get better? Asking them, how do they improve? How can you improve your own performance? How can we improve as a team? Give me a couple of things here. And like those are the conversations that enable those under 13s or 15s or 17s or seniors to actually start thinking for themselves and making decisions and seeing what's best for them and how they can plot a path to improvement for themselves.
But you're talking about a very difficult topic there. Like, excuse me, Mike. Questions. Like, what's an effective question to ask in a training session? And I would always tell, you know, especially coaches who are not as experienced with that way of coaching, if you're coaching through a lens of actually involving the players, giving them a voice and a choice, let's say, then you have to be pretty efficient at asking the right questions to get rich information out of the player that will help them to play better. And it's very simple. What are you noticing? Hey, Mike, time out, our subs. Mike, come over here, buddy. What are you seeing here? Just talk me through what you're seeing now. Bang, you're getting data what Mike is seeing. So I'm not now verbally vomiting on you. Mike, you need to rotate. Mike already knows he needs to rotate. So why am I telling him? Let me find out what he thinks first. And another simple question is, what's getting in the way of you performing well at the moment from your point of view? You know, and now you're talking about relationship building. So I think questioning is a very, very hard aspect of coaching, Mike. And I think us as coaches, we have to invest time in actually asking the right questions, plan questions on your session plan, start to scenario plan, you know, start to horizon plan. What could happen that I could ask a question to solve this problem of a player? You get some really rich information back, and you save your own voice as well. You go home with more energy instead of shouting the solution down the court, you know?
Yeah, and it's more enjoyable for the players too, though, Alan. You know,
way more enjoyable.
And like, you're talking about asking the right questions there, whereas, and I think, well, asking the right questions is obviously the desired thing at each age group. But as the older you get, the accuracy and the of the questions need to be better, obviously. But even if you're younger, if you're talking about real smallies, asking questions rather than giving a solution, even if it's not the right question, is forcing them to actually think and formulate an answer and come back to you with something. Well, maybe what they say isn't the right thing, but at least it's getting them into the idea of, okay, the coach is looking for my opinion. I've got to be tuned in to see what's going on, and I'm going to give an answer. And maybe if it's wrong, it's right, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But he's asking my opinion, so I'm going to have to give it to him. And then obviously as we get older, now we're getting a little bit more technical and a little bit more accurate about exactly what we are asking.
Yeah, and I think the thing to be mindful of there as well is, like, it's okay to tell. It's okay to be prescriptive, but it's not okay to be doing that 100% of the time. Yeah. And I think we live along a spectrum, and this is where the experienced coach, the Shawnee Burrows, the Russ Bradfords of the world were very good, I thought. They were very good at moving along that spectrum from guiding to following, mm-hmm. following us by asking you questions, guiding by telling us to asking us, where are you along that spectrum based on the context of what's going on in front of you, based on how that player is feeling, based on that player's experience and what you know of them. So you're back to now, a better understanding of who you coach will enable you to coach them better. Mm-hmm. And that's to enable you to ask them the right questions, or will enable you to say, right, here's the solution, here's the answer, because you need it. You're under pressure, or let me help you kind of thing. So that spectrum is important to know where to be, and you've got to be along at different points.
Yeah, and for sure. And again, like the younger kids, like, they definitely need a little bit more prescription. They do need more prescription than the older, as old as you get. But I still think, I just think that idea of coaches asking questions, I keep saying it, I think it's the most underutilized coaching tool that we have, that we don't do enough, but it's not prevalent enough in coaching, whereby, like, our first thing is, can we elicit the information out of them rather than, like you said there, you know, word vomit on top of them and telling them everything that we know.
Absolutely.
Which isn't really going to help them when they need to make a big decision. Alan, just like, because we've gone off on every kind of attention there as we possibly could, but that's no bad thing either. I'm just thinking, Alan, like for coaches that are not as experienced as what you've been doing, some of the things that you've found that you've struggled with a little bit, kind of the pitfalls or stumbling blocks that you've come across in your own kind of journey that would be related to people in sports, I suppose.
Very clear for me, Mike, very clear. Worried about what others think, you know, absolutely. I got to hold my hand up there, and there's no hiding from it. You know, you stand on the sideline there, and if you're coaching junior players, you've got the parents up in the balcony and wondering what they're thinking about your coaching. Will have you coaching in a way that maybe doesn't align with how you want to coach. Or if you go on the other end of the spectrum there, when you're coaching a pro team or players who are getting paid, and you've got the owner sitting over there in the stands or sitting behind the bench, actually listening to the timeouts. It could have you coaching in a way, like you said, that doesn't align to your true values as a coach. Mm. And I'm lucky that I don't have to worry about that anymore. And it's not that I don't have to worry about it because I'm not in the environment where I have to worry about it or I'm mature. It's actually, I've just kind of gotten over myself and I'm comfortable with who I am. I feel like at this stage, Mike, you know, now I've forensically recorded everything and I've sat in my office some days and I've put my hands over my face going, God, that was awful. Like, you know, the tantrums on the sideline. I have to tell you a quick story here. We were coaching against Sweden. Actually, you know, one of the assistant coaches for Sweden. I'll say his name in a minute. We were coaching against Sweden back in 2013 or 14, whatever it was, 3-game series in preparation for the European Championship. And my fiance Esther was a GB gymnast back in the day where it was a lot more, it was a Bobby Knight type of approach to coaching in the gymnastics world, right? She had the Russian gymnastic coaches, the German gymnastic, West Germany gymnastic coaches. Anyway, She came to game 3 of 3. Michael Bree was an assistant coach with the Swedish team at the time. She came to the third game on the Sunday. And we'd rolled over Sweden on Friday and Saturday. And Sunday was, you know, we took care of business again on Sunday in terms of results and outcome. So anyway, I'm thinking I'm the big coach, you know, I've done a great job here and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I jump in the car and we go home. She's very quiet. And I said, you're all right. She says, you know, I think you should, when you watch the game back, I think you should watch yourself more than the team because, you know, you're a bit heavy with them. And I was like, and straight away, it was like you put a needle in a balloon. The ego was just destroyed, like, you know, in one sentence. I didn't say anything, but it rattled me. It rattled the hell out of me. But I would say this. It was one of the turning points where I kind of turned the lens on myself here. And I did watch myself. I wasn't watching the plays we ran and all, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm the big coach. Look at me. Ran a good offense. We scored, blah, blah. I mean, the reality is Micah had incredibly talented players. That's why we won the game. I needed to get out of their way, actually, looking back on it. But that was one of the turning points. And I think it's shining the, turning the, like the Windex paradigm, as Ian McLeod says, you hold that mirror up in front of you, make sure it's crystal clear and make sure you're honest with what you see. But I love what you keep doing in this conversation. You keep taking it to the younger coaching, the younger players' pathway. And it's exactly the same thing. Like, you know, we've got to be very mindful about how we're coaching these younger players because they're going to be the coaches of the future, never mind the players of the future. If you're role modeling, you know, demonstrative behavior on the sideline, if you're role modeling inappropriate behavior on the sideline, which is too often prevalent, you're now dampening down the coaching profession for the future. Never mind the game, that's obvious. Never mind the performance or the sport. I got off on a massive tangent, man. I can't remember what the topic was.
No. There's been several, even just, and this is probably another little continuation of the tangent, but there's been several kind of relatively high profile incidents in juvenile sport, like over here in the last 6 months of, like, you know, managers or coaches fighting each other or getting involved in an altercation with kids or, you know, whatever it is. And I just think, like, if somebody had, like, as you did for your PhD, like, if somebody put a camera on every juvenile coach in all of Ireland, in the entire world, and just look at the stuff that goes on in youth sport in America and different things with coaches, new umpires and all that. Like, you put a camera on somebody and you actually go home and you ask that person, I want you just to watch yourself. Don't watch anything else about the game. Just watch you and what you did as a with your physical, your shouting, your roaring, what are you doing physically. Like, I think the vast majority of people would be hugely embarrassed by some of the stuff that they do.
I agree. Do you know, someone once said to me, Mike, I have to share this one with you. Someone once said to me, a very smart young man, like, you know, he's been coaching a long time. His point to me was, like, we should be equipping athletes these days to deal with abusive coaching. And I had to sit back and go, hang on a second. No, what we should be doing is challenging the behaviors of these coaches. I don't care if you're NCAA Division I, you've been there 30 years. If you're the under 12 or the under 14 coach at your club and you've been there 30 years and you've won 25 national titles, like, we should be challenging that behavior because it's unacceptable. It's a simple fact. In any other world, you know, if you did it above Mount Hawk inside the classroom, there'd be certain people called to come and take you away. But yet we open up a sports venue and we just say, go for it. It's an acceptable way to behave. It's not. I don't want to swear on here, but it's absolute BS. Absolute BS. And it is unacceptable. And we should challenge it. Now, we should challenge it in a way that's not conflicting. I feel we should challenge it in a way where we can have a healthy conversation with a person who's behaving in such a way. You know, we wouldn't accept it from a player, would we?
Not at all, man. Not at all. And I think that's why I probably keep, and I know I probably overdo it, but I keep going back to those younger age groups, Alan, because, like, it's cool with the level you're coaching at now and the stuff that you're doing, and I'm involved in a nice, you know, good level. But there's still so many kids drop out of sport at those younger age groups that I think, not all, some kids just realize it's not for them and they go their own direction, which is absolutely fine. But I still think there's a large percentage of kids that drop out of sport for a myriad of different reasons. But coaching is certainly one of those reasons. Like, And that's why I think I'm just I would just love to think that, you know, you could impact a couple of coaches that would impact several kids, and it would keep those people playing longer. Whether they ever go on and represent, you know, their country or their whatever, you know, it's irrelevant in one sense. But that's, I think that's probably why I do keep going back to Man, because I think we can do better as underage coaches in every sport, in every country in the world, you know? And I'm in absolutely no doubt, Alan, that I would think that 99, I would say 100% of coaches think what they're doing is the best, most positive thing that they can do for their team and for the kids that are playing in their club. The vast majority are in that bracket. But, you know, that still doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, we could just do it better. That's all. I think there's nobody, whether you're operating at the very, very top of the tree or you're operating down to the under sevens, I think we could all do it better. And by reaching out to people like you're suggesting, you know, talking to a more experienced coach or somebody else, I think that's a great way to learn and to improve and to ask questions again and to find better ways to do it. I think that's something for all of us, no matter how long we're coaching, everybody can improve. And it's that lifelong learning kind of, I suppose, approach to the whole thing, as opposed to just doing it the way that I've always done it because that's the way I did it when I was a kid. You know, that kind of an approach?
Yeah. Reflective practice. You know, you don't have to go down a rabbit hole. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? And how can I do it better? Just a bit of reflective practice after every training session. You'll do the kids a quality service. And I'll finish with this one on this topic, Mike. If you're not growing and developing as a coach, you should be seen to be doing a disservice to the people you're coaching. And it might be just finishing up your practice on the drive home, reflecting about that session. That's all it needs to be. It doesn't need to be much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Al, I'm conscious of your time now, man. So I'll wrap up shortly. Is there anything, Al, that we haven't really touched on that you think would be an important point to make?
Well, geez, the coaching domain's a rabbit hole, isn't it, Mike? We could go in so many different directions. The only last thing I'd add there is, like, what we're doing is a privilege. And I think that's an important message. Like, coaching young people or any age and at all, like any person in a place of being able to influence a group of people positively is a massively privileged position. Now, I'm preempting what I want to say by saying that. I think as coaches, we got to be very careful about our source of power. You know, because as soon as you put head coach before somebody's name or you give them that title, it could be a very dangerous place to be, because it does carry a lot of power and a lot of weight because of how people look to you. It doesn't matter if it's under 12s or professional level. And I think as coaches, we got to be very, very mindful how we're using that position and be careful, because we have different sources. So, for example, you know, let's go back to when Russ was coaching us. Russ had knowledge power. He knew more about the game than us. So that's a real privilege for him. And it's a very useful and very important that he shares that knowledge with all of us. He also had reward power, Mike. He was able to give us minutes, decide, and he had full control of that. We didn't really. He could decide whether you played 20 or 30 or 2. So he had reward power. I think coaches taking a bit of a dive on what's my source of power and just being aware of that will probably have you coaching slightly different or a little bit better than you currently are. So just being mindful of that is a huge one. And the other thing I want to say about coaching as well, while we're talking about it, just start to identifying your strengths and your stressors, you know, and I won't go down a rabbit hole here, but doing a self audit, what's my strengths as a coach, and then what stresses me out most as a coach. You know, a lot of the coaches I'm speaking to, Mike, there's a lot going on with them as they get into the season. And sometimes you need to stop and take stock of where you're at and where's your time going, because there's a lot of diminished returns for investment of time when you're a coach. And if you can get burnt out pretty quick, and you could become pretty moody and pretty saturated and quite negative to be around pretty quick, especially if the losses are coming in and you really care about the score, whether it's under 14s or seniors. So just take stock, step back, remind yourself, this is a privilege. I'm doing well. What's stressing me out? What are my strengths? Amplify your strengths, dampen your stressors, and go again. Pressing the reset button regularly throughout the season, I feel, is critical.
I'll let you go on this one. I'm going back to your videoing because I do think that's a very fascinating exercise to look at. What did you say? Like, were your biggest kind of improvements as a consequence of really reflecting on your own performance through that video? What were the things that you really improved on because of that process?
I think I became very aware of my body language. See, John,
we're nearly out the gap and you've been going for 40 minutes and you got to go back again.
Well, anyway, I'll tell you what, Mike, I'm very mindful, like, and this may sound strange what I'm about to say, right? But I'm very mindful. I don't have a facial expression that says, welcome, I'm a kind, loving person. That's just reality. And the way my body language, the video has really widened my lens to it. It's narrowed my focus, actually, on how I come across just with my body language and facial expressions. And I've had to make, it does take energy from me, Mike, to actually come in there and without saying anything, look like that I'm a happy, welcoming, I care, and I'm here for you type person. It really takes a lot of energy for me to do it because my face is not structurally built that way. And my body language is definitely not built that way. So that's one of the things that probably maybe you wouldn't have thought that came out of it. But that was definitely one I have to be intentional about, how I physically approach a player sometimes, or the group in particular.
Yeah, be intentional about your body language even that, man. A smile can be a powerful weapon at times.
Powerful weapon. It's not necessarily what was on the outside. My intention and outcome were very different very often, and it was having an impact on players' feelings. So yeah, it's a real eye opener. Real eye opener.
There'll be coaches now up and down Ireland in the next couple of weeks with someone getting videoed with camera phones to see what they're like when they're approaching players.
Speaking of Irish coaches, Mike, I'll get a quick one in here. Just from afar, obviously, like living in Scotland, living in England for the past 15, 16 years, I'm only getting the perception on Twitter and social media and reading the paper online and stuff like that. Like, there seems to be wonderful stuff going on with coaching in Ireland. And I'll go out on a limb and say I think it's ahead of the UK. I really do. I think I do. There's some fascinating, I'm reading reports in the, I forget his name. I keep up to date with what's happening in the coaching world, and it's refreshing from my point of view anyway. Now, others may argue differently, and I may not know enough, but with the data I have, it looks like it's heading in a good direction back home.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of energy about it. You know, I think people are recognizing that, like, it's so huge. Like, coaching is so massive, an unpaid industry in terms of how we can keep people involved in sport for longer, and then how we can develop them into people who want to compete at a high level if that's their direction. And I think there's a real energy around, like, how can we best facilitate both of those, you know, participation and performance sport. And people are looking for information. They're mad for, you know, I have a lot of people contacting me about these, asking me for, you know, this bit of information, that bit of information. And I think that's good. It's healthy. It's positive, man. And geez, the more people are looking for information, like, sure, that's only good, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good stuff, buddy.
Alan, thanks a million, man. I appreciate your time. I know you were under pressure there today. So
no problem.
Thanks a million for that. It was great to catch up with you and be called John about 50 times. But for those of you listening again, folks, just to remember that this is a fundraiser for Recovery Haven in Tralee, who are an organization who provide free cancer support services for the people of Kerry and beyond. So if you did find some value in that episode or any of the episodes, obviously they and myself would appreciate a donation to the fundraising page. That will be, there's a link attached on my Twitter page at Mike Quirker in the podcast description below. So thank you very much, everybody. And Alan, again, thanks very much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Mike.
Good stuff.